St. John's Lutheran Church of Northfield is celebrating its 150th anniversary in 2019. As part of this sesquicentennial, the church is conducting oral history interviews that will help to preserve the history of the church and the experience of our longtime members. Today is October 20th, 2019. I am Eric Sponheim from the Evangelism and Communications Committee. I'm joined by longtime St. John's members, Gunta and Aline Mosler. Thank you for joining me, and let's turn to the first question. When did you first join St. John's, and what brought you here? And we've just talked a little bit about this in the pre-interview, and it's quite a remarkable story. So, take us back there, Gunter, to 1944, and cover that ground for us.
Okay. I was born in 1940, and shortly afterwards, the war started in Romania, and in 1944, my mother, in September of 1944, my mother and I, my grandmother and her youngest sister, fled from Romania because the Russians were invading, and we ended up living in Austria, and as luck would have it, we were what ended up the American sector of Austria. My dad, by chance, found us in a refugee camp in Austria. There were three of them, and nobody knew who was in what camp, but he, by chance, found someone that kind of found out where we're at and told him, and he found us in this camp. And then we lived in Austria until 1952. My dad was lucky. He found a small town area where there was a farmhouse that we lived in upstairs, and he got a job as a baker in that small town because the baker's two sons were in a German military somewhere, and he had no clue whether they were alive or not. And so my dad worked there till his two sons came back, and then he ended up going to work on construction jobs, which was part of the reconstruction of Europe, the Marshall Plan. So he was working for a company that was rebuilding roads and bridges and so forth. But the opportunity, my two brothers were born in Austria in 1946 and 48, and in 1951 or so, they were starting to talk about immigration. They could see there was no opportunity. My dad thought he could always find a bakery and start over again, but my mother was pretty insistent about, no, there's no opportunity for the kids. Let's apply for immigration. And they did. And Gertrude Sovik, who was from Northfield, which we didn't know until later on, was in charge of Lutheran World Services. And by 1952, St. John's offered to sponsor the family, and we finally left Germany on a ship on April 10th, 1952, and arrived in New York on April 20th, 1952, and after going through immigration checks and so forth at Ellis Island, then they took us to a train that took us to Chicago, where we switched and ended up coming into Minneapolis late at night the following day and a half, whatever it took for the train to get here. At that point, Pastor Bjorn and George Campbell, and there was a Hungarian by the name of, and I remember the last name was Varga, but I can't remember his first name. He was a janitor here at the church, also an immigrant. But because he spoke Hungarian, and my parents spoke Hungarian, the communications was pretty good. And after they picked us up at the train depot in Minneapolis, they brought us to Northfield. And they had a living quarters at Pine Hill in one of those barracks that was up there. And we lived, well, St. John's then took us into the community of the church and got us arranged, made arrangements for a grocery store so that my mother could go and get groceries, and they kept track of it on a monthly basis, and then they paid it, you know, and made things a little easier to get along. My dad ended up working on a turkey farm until latter part, well, till September when school got started, and there was a baker there that had was planning on retiring within a year, and he spoke German, so that helped my dad start converting from metric type system to...
Oh, right, you measure things when you're baking,
yeah,
don't you?
Right,
yeah.
In the bakery. And my dad worked there till he was, till he retired at 65, and my mother got a job in one of the girls' dormitories in the kitchen, and she worked for Carlton until she retired. So then both parents, they had bought a house. We lived not far from the church here, about a block and a half up here, after we moved from Pine Hill to here. And in 1955, they bought a house that was moved onto South Spring Street, which was one of the first homes down in that area. They built a new basement, and they brought in this, what was a farmhouse at one time was what next to Cordell Motors, which was a Chrysler dealer. They needed a parking lot, so they picked up the house and they put it on this new basement. And that's where they lived till they finally went to the senior home for after their retirement.
So many potential follow-up questions here. I'll try to be judicious because we can talk a little more another time or after the recorder's off. But I would like to know a little more about the immediate post-Second World War years. Was there enough to eat? Was that your family was in Austria? I mean, you from 45 until you came over at what?
52.
Tell us, let's just sketch that in a little bit. Going to 45 to 52, was there enough to eat? I mean, I think my perception is those were pretty lean years
very
post-war
lean.
Europe.
Yeah. There was very little food, hard to get. Yeah. Although I think there was food brought in, but you know, when the Marshall Plan and some of that started,
right.
I think with some brought. But for the most part, to start with, you had to depend on the local farmers that were around there that did. And my dad, of course, having gotten a job in a bakery, meant that we had at least bread and maybe some other things. And then I think things started to improve as more and more people were working and money was flowing, and they were bringing, obviously, food from the United States, I'm sure, because there was much else in other countries around there. Everybody had the same dilemma after the war. And clothing was, you know, my mother had a sewing, my grandmother did a lot of sewing, so she sewed clothes for us and all that, and she also was good enough for, she was sewing clothes for people that did have a, you know, pretty good income, because in that small town we lived in, there was a supposedly a cure center of some kind, and people were coming in from other parts of Europe for treatment, and because my grandmother was sewing some pretty nice looking clothes, she was making enough so that helped spread out the cost of buying things with food or whatever. And
what was the name of the little town in Austria?
Galspach. Galspach.
What was it near in terms of a regional center town?
It would be southwest of Linz. Linz is the big city on the Danube.
Okay.
And it'd be probably, I'm guessing now, 80 miles, 90 miles southwest of there. There was a big military base, Army, U.S. military base at Wells, which was not that, it was kind of halfway in between, because that part of Austria ended up being U.S. sector. Austria was split in four different regions, French, English, Russian, American.
We were talking before turning the recorder on some about U.S. immigration policy right after the war regarding ethnic Germans. Can you talk about that? Eileen, you had a lot of facts at your fingertips on that.
Well, Right after World War II, the U.S. immigration policy did not allow for the immigration of German ethnics. A lot of people were brought in from Lithuania.
So not just people from Germany,
German ethnics were not allowed in, but ethnic Lithuanians, Poles, Estonians, Latvians were all allowed in. French, a lot of different countries, but not German ethnics. Even if they were from Poland or, there were German colonies all over.
That's just bitterly ironic, isn't it, considering what the war was about, which is opposing that type of ethnic rigidity.
But it wasn't, I think it was in around 1950 that they opened it up to ethnics. And that's when, Gunther's mother decided they really needed to apply and come. And as Gunther was explaining, Gertrude Solvik is the person who was working with Lutheran World Services who saw the picture of the family and decided they belonged in Northfield and that St. John should sponsor them. And they came.
And St. John sponsored a number of families that came from all different regions. There must have been these 10, 12, 15 families over a period of 3-4 years.
Gertrude Solvik.
Yeah, she was, ironically, she was my German teacher at St. Olaf. I didn't know any of this at the time. I didn't know I was going to be marrying Gunther. But she taught German after she left the Lutheran World Service. She came back to St. Olaf and taught German there.
There was another lady that was a member of the church. She worked there and part of the Brittany
Roberg.
Roberg. She just passed away recently, but she worked for the State Department.
Brittany Roberg was with the State Department, and she was a good friend of Gertrude's.
Yeah.
And she was telling about the, when I was visiting with Brittany a couple years ago. And she was saying that things in Austria were just absolutely horrific, that a lot of people were dying of starvation, and that, the Mosler family was indeed lucky to be where they were and have, be able to get the food they needed and survive. And I think, Gunther was just a little boy, so he doesn't remember it, but I remember his mother saying that when they were still on the train, he wanted his aunt to get him some milk because he hadn't had milk for so long.
Yeah, that's true.
And another indication of the conditions there is after his younger brother was born, she said there was virtually nothing for clothing. But the Red Cross had piles of cotton. And so they would spin cotton, and she knit baby clothes out of the cotton that they had spun. So it was, things were really, really very difficult for
them.
Pretty
self-sufficient in trying to make do without whatever you could get, It just was, Austria was, in shambles. They had no government there because of the four zones that we were split up on. So they had no say what's going on.
I know later they talked, there was the Wirtschaftswunder. There was kind of an economic miracle, but that didn't happen right away. So Gertrude Solvik was your German professor at St. Olaf before she went to work for the Lutheran.
Afterwards.
Afterwards.
She was with Lutheran World Services. And then came to, they were from Northfield originally, the Solvik family, was very much affiliated with St. Olaf College. There was Ansgar Solvik, who taught religion at St. Olaf. Edwin Solvik, who was the architect, and Gertrude. And they were all related.
They're all related, yeah.
Yeah, but they weren't necessarily, I think one was the, there was a brother and maybe two brothers. I don't know how it worked, but they were all of the same generation.
Got it. I will pursue that further. I am trying to get Ann Sovic to do one of these interviews with me, and she's being a little coy about it because she says, oh, I've only been here since 2001. That's not a long-time member. I'm telling her that's a long-time member. all right, well, tell me how you met. We were saying before the recorder was on that it was Northfield High School.
Gunther was a year older than I in high school, and we were friends. We double dated and stayed friends. I went to St. Olaf. He went into the Air Force, and we just, you know, we wrote back and forth. And then I think it was about my senior year when he got out of the Air Force that we started getting rather serious in our relationship, and then we got married in 1963 after I had left St. Olaf and graduated from the University of Minnesota.
I went to electronic school a couple of years after the Air Force, 4 years in the Air Force, and it was the second year in electronic school that Ellie and I got married. I worked days and went to school nights for 2 years, and then I went to work for Northwestern Bell in Grand Forks, North Dakota. Air Force were putting in missile sites, and they needed technicians that were familiar with microwave systems and all that kind of stuff. But I started out climbing poles and kind of worked, and we moved about 7 times, and all promotions over that 25 years I worked for Northwestern, well, actually 23 years for Northwestern Bell, and then when the Bell system broke up, the division that I had stayed with AT&T, and I was project manager at that point and doing installations on big air bases in Grand Forks and Minot and Rapid City, South Dakota. And then I got transferred to Minneapolis, where I managed 6 or 7 project managers for Fortune 500 companies that are located here in Minnesota. At that time, it was Northwest Airlines, Control Data, Dayton Hudson, on and on and on, you know. And then they came out with an early offer, so I took it, which was a good move. And I think I was off about 6 months. And Dayton's was looking for someone to manage their communications group because Target was starting to mushroom, growing great. And of course, Dayton's had bought Marshall Fields, and they had Hudson's out of Detroit, and they had call centers in each one of those. And my original job was to try to bring all the centers into Minneapolis, and it didn't take very long, but the guy that was the director said, why don't you just stay on and manage the group for a while? Well, 9 years later, I said, enough. So I was in the communications world for about 34 years.
Oh, Billy. We could have a separate forum on economic development. We could have, because I've had two of these interviews have been with economists, Carl Hella and Bill Carlson, both from who've been St. Olaf economics. So like that'd be a kind of a separate thread we could pursue. But when did you, well, St. John's quite literally brought you here. Yeah. When then did you kind of move back here and start getting more involved in the congregation?
Well, when I got transferred back to Minneapolis, and then we decided to build a home on Lake Bilsby in
91. Oh, Lake Bilsby.
91?
Sure. 91 we built, yeah.
And friends of ours invited us to join St. Peter's. And we did, but it never felt like home. And we then transferred to St. John's. And it is old, you know. St. Peter's had nice people, and I have nothing against them, but it just did not feel like being here, you know.
That's where you used to live, out of Lake Bilsby?
Yes, we do. You know, one of the stories you might tell that relates to St. John's is your Sunday school experience.
Oh. Yeah, I was in sixth grade. Well, April was just about the end of the school year, and went to school up here at Longfellow, and on Wednesdays we had what they called Wednesday school. They let you go for an hour, and you went to the, and we came down here to church, and Ed Lotsolem, who was a Phi Ed instructor at St. Olaf, was one of the people that conducted not only the Wednesday program, but Sunday school also. And her husband was a professor at St. Olaf, was a math professor, wasn't he? Mm-hmm. Yeah. They called him Lightning Art, but he talked so slow you could take all notes. Bart was a great people. Anyway, I delivered papers for a job up and down First Street, Second Street, Third Street here. And Solems were on that route. And so I, you know, they always were very nice to me. And Edla was just a great person for Sunday school. She had total control. Kids respected her. There was no fooling around. Years later, Eileen's brother married Solems' daughter. And so we've been very close to that family until, well, they're both passed away now, but their daughter is living in South Dakota, and Helen's brother just passed away here a couple of weeks ago. But Solems, Edlo particularly, though, was always close to us, and they have a cabin in northern Minnesota, and they invited us years ago that we traveled from North Dakota to the cabin, and had gone to the cabin a number of times when they were up there, so they were kind of part of our family, really, you know. Neat people.
S-O-L-E-M?
S-O-L-U-M.
U-M.
Yeah, they were longtime members, I mean.
Oh, yeah, she was very active in the church here.
And her first name, how is it spelled out?
Edlo, E-D-L-O.
Oh, okay. Unusual name.
It is, yeah.
And his name was Art Solem.
Okay. And so Edlo taught you in the church school program?
Yep.
Was it Sunday morning or was it Wednesday?
Sunday mornings and Wednesday.
Oh, twice a week?
Twice a week.
Same. Oh.
During the school year.
Okay.
And they only did that in sixth grade and seventh grade and on. They didn't have a Wednesday school for high school kids or junior high school.
Well, actually, we did. Because I remember going, moved here when I was 15. I remember being released because I went to the Congregational Church across from the school, and we would be released on Wednesday afternoons.
Yeah, I don't remember coming over here from the high school, but I do from long ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, I experienced that too in the early 70s, that release time format in Minnesota, small town in Minnesota. Wow, kind of blown the prepared questions out of the water. We've already got a gold mine here recorded, so it's all a bonus now. How about just change over time at St. John's? From your first impressions of the congregation when you started coming here to where we're at now. I mean, music and worship or having weekly communion compared to like monthly or whatever it was before. Just any impressions there?
The church, of course, is growing. I mean, it was just the main building, and then Sunday school was in the basement. The additions were built later. We weren't even around when they built those additions.
Yeah.
At that time they had two pastors, and I was confirmed here when I was 15, 16. And services, I can't say that, I don't know how much it changed during all the time that we were gone, because we lived in North Dakota 23 years, and then up in Apple Valley a year and a half, 2 years before we built the house. So there, you know, obviously the service pretty much is the same, but different people know. And the congregation, if you look around, they're my age or older in some cases. And there are young kids in the families. And that's kind of nice to see, you know. I don't know what else I would say.
Well, I think
other than being involved in different committees, Eileen's involved in.
Oh, yeah, tell me about those. I would like to. Yeah, tell me about those.
Yeah, I'm involved with the stewardship committee. Ann Hoff and I are currently co-chairs of that.
Okay.
And I'm on the Faith and Health Committee, so.
So we're both currently doing the
yes.
Area. Right.
And others as well, other committees previously? In the
no,
this is the first time for both of
okay.
us. But it's been a couple, 3-4 years now. So.
Yeah. And we were not very active except for attending.
Yeah. Who looped you in to the committee service?
I don't know. Gunther got a call.
I think Howard Thorsheim asked me, and I got on the committee when he was on it, and he's since then gone off, but I'm still on the committee, and I don't know who.
Stewardship, and then which one for you?
Faith and Health.
Faith and Health, okay. And Howard Thorsheim invited you to that one?
Okay.
And I should say for the recorder, because it hasn't really come up directly since we turned it on, that Gunther brought Edna Hong's book, the book called Book of a Century, written back in 1969 on the centennial of the congregation. Gertrude Sovick, are there other influential people that we should mention? Because when we do these interviews, and we've done probably 25 of these now, and we try to do some cross-tagging, so you know we like connect the threads of the interviews. Any other people like that we should mention that are influential?
Were immigrants? Or?
Yeah.
Eric Hong was he and his sister were adopted by the Hong family, Howard and Edna. And Eric was one of my high school classmates. And his sister was a little bit older, so I didn't get to know her real well. But Eric and I see each other quite often, class reunions, or here he serves and he ushers quite a bit in the first service, and I see him at time between services and or class reunions, whatever, you know. But I don't think there is any of the people that were, and there were a number of families in Northfield, that they have either, the parents have passed away and the kids probably have gone, moved somewhere else after they got out of school or college or whatever they attended.
Well, I was going to say the one we've kept contact with is Malda Steinberg's, and the Steinberg family was...
From Latvia,
and they were brought over by St. John's also.
Yeah, Malda was one of my high school classmates, and she lives in Texas.
And then we have, you know, because we grew up here, we have, you know, like the Leipolds are friends. Dave is a high school classmate.
But they were...
Judy and George Pence. Mm-hmm. Judy's a classmate.
Even high school classmates, there aren't all that many that are around here. Or there are some that are around here but never go to church.
Well, let's close up by just looking, if you have, do you have any final reflections that we haven't, things we haven't touched upon since the recorder's been on, or... anything to add like that?
My comment is that I'm really, really thankful that St. John's offered to take our family in. And, even though my brothers are living elsewhere, I got one living in Hawaii and another one in Morristown, Minnesota, it gave us an opportunity to be like everybody else in this country, succeed in getting an education, a job, and family, and we get a thing. Or we have two kids that are daughter and a son, and they each have two kids, and everybody's healthy and doing well, and the family tree just keeps growing. And since all of the things that have gone on, we've had the opportunity to go back to Romania, where I still have some cousins living there, and Elaine and I went back and got to meet them all, and then when we came back and told our kids about this, they all wanted to go. So we made arrangements and had a family reunion in my town that I was born in, which was, and they're on, you know, Facebook and some of those things right now, some of the relatives. And then this last spring, we took a trip to New Zealand and Australia, and one of my cousins from Romania has a son that lives in Perth, Australia. So we got to meet him and his wife and their two kids, and they left Romania in 1999, because even now Romania is still trying to recover, and there was no real opportunity for their kids. And he was an electrical engineer, and his wife, I think, was a mechanical engineer or something. And so they decided to move to Australia. And their first jobs were like washing dishes in restaurants and doing all kinds of odd jobs till they finally were able to get into their profession. And he's working for the power company in Perth, and she's a project manager for an investment company, which is really kind of different from her college training, but they've done well. They're doing, they have their own home, and the kids have been educated. They're both employed, and we had a great time out there. We, you know, it's,
well, it's, yeah, I think the story is how this story is being repeated by other members of the family generations later.
Yeah. And the ones in Romania, like my one cousin, the other cousin, that's the youngest one, he has two daughters, and the older one is a family practitioner. She's a doctor and teaches in a medical school, and she teaches in Hungarian, Romanian, and German, the course that she teaches. Her sister, also a family practice, but specialized in...
She's a pediatrician.
Yeah, and she had moved to Germany because she needed to get some other certifications and all that, and she just stayed in Germany. So, you know, they all have done fairly well, but Romania is still recovering. And it's all about the oil. Mm-hmm. One of our neighbors on the lake is working for a company that is working with the Romanian government to do some exploration work. You know?
Well, for years they had that notorious dictator, Ceausescu. And what you've been telling me here about, you know, the family members in Australia and elsewhere, it is exactly as you said, Aline, it's, you're part of that broader story of really finding ways to keep living vibrant lives despite iron curtain, as Churchill's phrase was, that came down. And that's, I guess the curtain is still coming down. Churchill's still trying to get the curtain down, probably.
The country is pretty well intact now. Some of the border things that were put back together again, but the economy is just now starting to come, and it'll be a while. They're still building roads and freeways and homes. Well, a lot of the homes are built, fairly nice homes, but there's a lot of stuff that was built during the Russian period, apartment houses, just bland-looking apartments.
Concrete bunkers is what they look like. But I think, what was really fascinating is to see the contrast. We got off the plane, his cousin picked us up, we're driving through a little village, and we see a horse-drawn cart with the tassels hanging from the bits on the horses. And it looked like we'd just traveled right back into National Geographic. I mean, it was just amazing. And then we got a little further down the road, and here comes a big John Deere tractor. So the contrast, it was just incredible.
Yeah, the scenery.
But the society is like that too.
Yeah.
I mean, you see you saw literally shepherds out in the fields with their dogs and whatever, looking as they might have looked 100 or more years ago. And then you see the research that's being done by, you know, one of his relatives on genetics and whatever. And so the contrast is just really, really interesting in how it, but, you know, there's progress and then for some and not for others. And we see that here today in this country, that, you know, the progress for some is much greater than it is for others, and the opportunities.
Agriculture is still kind of conducted like it was then. You don't have farm homes scattered all over. They have little communities, and they're all farmers, but each one has their piece of land. And even one night we were watching a Keweenaw's town, and all these cows were marching down. Well, they take their cows and take them down to get them milked, and then they march them back home again. You see all that variety, and then, of course, you see the big operation with the John Deere tractors and all that, too.
I almost feel like we should have had a map. We were here with some nice framed prints by Arnold Flotten and other religious, and some, I believe it was John Walters did these, I believe. So we're here with some really nice artworks, but for this interview, I feel like we should have had a map on the wall. I mean, with places we've covered. Thank you so much. Anything, Eileen, anything you'd like to add before we turn
just
off the button?
I guess I'm really grateful to St. John's for many reasons. I mean, I have my husband because of St. John's, but then I really appreciate what they're doing currently in the community. The outreach that they have to the broader community, and the caring for the people within the congregation as well as without. And I feel that it does a marvelous job of really doing what we need to do. I'm really excited about the caring for the earth emphasis that we have now. And I just feel like St. John's is headed in a really good direction, and I'm glad to be part of it.
Yeah, you feel that coming from the pastors and all that you see in all community and people that members of the church that are really want to have this country do as well as everybody else does. But
I agree, it is a really special time here. They, in Greek, there's the word kairos, which means the opportune time, the special time when, and it does seem like that. I feel that this morning getting to talk with you. So thank you so much.